From West Virginia to Oklahoma, Ohio to Nevada, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Bernie Sanders is pushing a single-payer healthcare system with an eye-popping $32 trillion price tag. Robert Graybois of the Mercatus Center is here to explain why even that estimate is low. Republicans held a hotly contested congressional seat in Ohio this past week, but Matt Matkowiak of the Potomac Strategy Group explains why that race marks the start of what will be a hotly contested election season. California is using prison inmates to help fight the current round of wildfires, but the state prohibits anyone with a criminal record from becoming a firefighter. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine is here to discuss. And the left was a cheerleader for the Russians until Donald Trump came along. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. It has the Orwellian name, Medicare for All, touted by Senator Bernie Sanders and the Democrat Socialist Movement as universal health care. But it comes at a budget-busting price tag of over $32 billion. Here to take a look at the proposal and its cost is Robert Graybois. He is a senior research fellow with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Bob, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Bob, we have Bernie Sanders and the Socialist Democrat movement out pushing for a single-payer health care system. You have been commenting on some research that is talking about the cost of that. What would the cost of a single-payer health care system that covered everybody and was paid for by the government, what would that cost us?
Well, the real answer is who knows. But my extraordinarily cautious and meticulous colleague, Chuck Blahouse, did a study that just went out, and it went viral and kind of explosive. Chuck said, let me be as generous as one can possibly be. Let us assume that if Senator Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All bill were to pass, let's suppose it did everything that Senator Sanders thinks it would do and has said it would do. And now we can get into what that means, because there are some pretty astonishing assumptions built into it. Chuck's study said, if the new law did everything Senator Sanders thinks, over a 10-year period, America would spend $2 trillion less on health care. Sounds big, but it's actually pretty small. That would be about a 3% cut. Big number, small percentage. However, and this was really what Chuck was looking at, the federal government's obligations would rise over that 10 years by $32.6 trillion. Now, somehow the government would have to pay for that. And as he noted, they could double all income taxes, all corporate taxes, and that still would not be enough to pay for Senator Sanders' bill. Now, Chuck, again, is very meticulous, very fair, very honest, and said, okay, so now the Sanders people correctly note that if this were the case, you know, people like me, I would no longer be paying for insurance premiums, nor would my employers. That would compensate me somewhat. On the other hand, there are plenty of people who wouldn't get that. So if you're a retiree who's on Medicare and thinks you've already paid for the health care for the rest of your life, and you don't have a full-time job and private health insurance, you're going to see your taxes double, too, on your retirement income, your pension, your IRA withdrawals, second job, part-time job that you might have, your investments. So those people would be paying loads. Plus, corporate taxes would double, which means we'd go back to before the 2017 reform. And all those bonuses that people are getting because of the tax law would be gone. So there'd be a whole lot of people losing out in big ways. You would immediately end up firing, I don't know, 500,000 to 1 million people who work in the health insurance industry. And you have to hope that they find some new work. Maybe the government hires them. Maybe they don't. So there are enormous costs.
Isn't one of the assumptions that those involved in providing medical care, doctors, nurses, hospitals, pharmaceutical industry, that they would essentially take a 40% cut in pay and the cost of their products? Is that even remotely realistic?
No. In the 1990s, they passed sustainable growth rate, which was to cap the compensation the doctors and hospitals got on Medicare payments. And for close to 20 years, Congress said every single year, you know, let's not do that this year. Let's do it next year. And then we're really going to do it next year. They never did it. They finally said, you know, we're never actually going to do this, so why don't we just take it off the books? And you're going to say, we're going to cut your salary on a significant chunk of your income by about 40%, but we expect you to work longer hours, to see more people in that time, to work better, to work smarter, et cetera. And this will be for nurses, too. Interestingly, the nursing profession, a large percentage of the nursing profession is really enthusiastic about this Medicare for All idea. And I don't know that it has sunk in that, well, part of that means you're going to take a huge pay cut, but you're going to have to work harder.
And of course, nobody is obviously going to do that, because if you take a 40% cut in pay, that certainly doesn't incentivize you to work harder. So we're looking at a situation where the savings that are projected are unrealistic. And as we saw with the so-called Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, the cost projections were unrealistically low. So this whole $32 trillion thing is, as you put it, probably the most generous low number you could have, despite the fact that Bernie Sanders and you have this socialist democratic movement out there. Is this all really more hot air because the whole thing just simply doesn't add up in any way, shape, or form?
I don't know. I mean, that's a political question. I don't know. You know, there are a lot of things that happen in U.S. politics that I wouldn't have ever bet on before. There is a remarkably large and rather off-putting enthusiasm about the socialist idea. It seems to be something we have to learn about one generation, that like each generation go through a period of enthusiasm about that. I'm a baby boomer, and certainly loads of my contemporaries went through that, and now we're getting a lot of the millennials doing it. I have a hard time imagining this thing passing. You did have, for instance, Vermont passed a single-payer bill, and then as it was time to push the button on it, it was getting closer, and they lifted the cost. They said, maybe we're not going to do this.
We often look to the states as we refer to them, laboratories of democracy. We like states to sort of pilot project a lot of these major policy changes. Has any state gone to a single-payer health care system?
No, I mean, the California Senate voted for one, I guess it was last year. You know, if any state is going to be enthusiastic about it, they have Democratic supermajorities. There is a strong enthusiasm for the idea. The California Nurses Association is wildly enthusiastic about the idea. But again, when it went from the Senate to their assembly, the lower house, they started looking at the numbers, and very much in line with Chuck Longhouse's study, said, this will cost us far more than the entire state budget costs now. So maybe we don't exactly know how we would pay for this thing.
Well, there's one fact of life, and that is there is no free lunch. Somewhere along the road, somebody has to pay for it. We have been talking with Robert Graybois, who is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. And Bob, tell us a bit about the Mercatus Center, also where folks can go to read more about this.
Mercatus is a center located at George Mason University. It's an academic research institute. We adhere to academic standards, and basically we research markets. We research the ways in which markets work in the economy. You can find out lots more by going to Mercatus, that's M-E-R-C-A-T-U-S, which is the Latin word for market, mercatus.org. And if you're in particular interested in health, go into the site and just type health search and all this stuff will come up. My stuff, Chuck's stuff, other people.
Robert Graybois of the Mercatus Center. Bob, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Lauren.
Normally, Andy Roth at the Club for Growth sits in with us at this time, but it is summer and Andy's taking a little vacation. So we are very pleased to welcome Matt Koyak, who is president of the Potomac Strategies Group. He's also a columnist for the Washington Times. He has his own podcast. We'll talk more about that a little bit later. Matt, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. I'm glad Andy's on vacation. He deserves it.
He surely does. And it looks like a lot of folks involved with politics should be on vacation. But of course, the summer, this off election year is anything but restful. We had a special election, Matt, in Ohio this past week. It appears as though the Republican won still some votes to be counted, but I'd be interested in your take on how that race turned out and the significance of that race.
Obviously, we're in primary season around the country. We'll be for another 3 or 4 weeks as the remaining states hold their primaries. And primaries, I think, are more important than special elections because special elections are on a random day, particularly those in the summer when people aren't paying attention. So I think sometimes we overstate how important or the meaning of a random special election is. That said, directionally, it can tell you certainly some things that are valuable. Look, this is this Ohio 12th district was an R plus 10 district, Republican plus 10 district. It's generally a district that should not be competitive. It hasn't been outside of Republican hands for 20 or 30 years. And in this case, you did have this special election in the summer with a state senator on the Republican side named Troy Balderson, who was, I think, underperforming through much of the special election, and then a Democrat named Danny O'Connor, who was tapping into labor unions and progressive support and was overperforming. And so the early vote numbers did not look good. They looked like there was a chance really early in that first week of early voting that the Republicans could lose the seat, which would have been a real sort of disaster nationally in terms of momentum and sort of the narrative for the midterms. Ultimately, the president came in at the very end, did a rally just outside of Columbus 3 days before the special election, and that, I think, carried Balderson to what appears to be a 1% victory. There's still a few thousand votes that have to be counted that are provisional ballots. The margin is about 1,500 votes, I think. So, well, more than likely, Balderson will win. It's going to take some time for the votes to be counted and for it to be finalized. What does it tell us for the midterms? That's the real question. What it tells us is that Democratic enthusiasm is high, and there's some question as to how high Republican enthusiasm is. And if Republicans don't turn out in 20, 30, 40 targeted House districts across the country, Democrats have a chance of winning those seats. They need to net a total of 23 seats to take back the majority in Congress. And Lohman, we know how significant that is, or people should know. There are three primary reasons why majority control of Congress matters so much. If the Democrats take control of the House back, number one, they're going to use subpoena power immediately to investigate President Trump, Vice President Pence, senior White House staff, cabinet secretaries, and folks who work in the administration. They're going to do that nonstop for 2 years. Number two, they're going to, I believe, bring articles of impeachment against President Trump in the first 90 days. Doesn't mean he'll be removed from office. Does mean he could be impeached, which would then send it to the Senate, which requires a two-thirds vote to be removed from office. I see that as highly unlikely. But it still would paralyze Washington, and it would probably affect President Trump's reelection. And then finally, Trump's legislative agenda would be shut down. And that's significant, given that he's only halfway through his first term. If House Democrats control that side of the Capitol, Trump's going to have a very difficult time moving anything legislatively that he wants to do, whether that be an immigration reform bill, whether that be trade-related legislation, another tax cut, infrastructure, all kinds of things he wants to do. So the stakes are really high. We still don't know exactly what the environment's going to be. Generally, the environment gets set around Labor Day when people come back from vacations and when kids are back in school and people start paying attention to the news again. So we are in the final 89 days of the election, and here in a couple of weeks, we're going to really be in the final 60 days, and that's when things will really get interesting.
In terms of that overall atmosphere that this fall election is going to be conducted, Matt, of course, it sort of ebbed and flowed from the beginning of the year. Initially, it seemed like there might be a blue wave. Then that sort of receded a little bit. It looked like Republicans might do well. Democrats may be staging a little bit of a comeback. But as we look at this, and you're talking about these congressional races being fought in a lot of suburban districts around the country, how does the Democrat Party's lurch to the left? And we saw a longtime Democrat upended by a Democratic socialist. That ultra-left wing of the Democrat Party appears to be ascendant. Is that something that's going to greatly complicate Democrats' efforts to win these swing districts?
Certainly could, and that's one of the really big questions about this midterm. One of the interesting things is that with the exception of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, this kind of came out of nowhere progressive candidate that knocked off the number four Democrat in the House, Joe Crowley, in a primary a couple weeks ago in New York, What's been interesting is that these sort of progressive candidates have really not been succeeding across the country in challenging incumbent, more mainstream Democrats. Now, I think that the progressives are on the march and are gaining momentum in terms of moving the party ideologically in their direction, whether it be abolish ICE, whether it be sanctuary cities, whether it be impeaching Trump, whether it be a $32 trillion Medicare for All proposal. The party is, I think, moving in that direction and in some ways being dragged there by their base. But yes, it has an effect on the midterms because ultimately those Democratic challengers are going to be forced to take a position. Are you for Medicare for All, which costs $32 trillion over 10 years? Are you for sanctuary cities? Are you for abolishing ICE? And those Democratic candidates are going to risk turning off the progressive base or taking positions that put them outside the mainstream of most voters. And in swing districts, the margin is very, very, very tight. You could be talking about 1% or 2% that could determine a couple dozen of these seats, which will determine control. So there is a civil war going on inside the Democratic Party. It is nice to finally see them go through one, since the Republicans were engaged in that for several years as well with the Tea Party movement. I actually think that the sort of civil war inside the Democratic Party is going to manifest itself in more compelling and fundamental ways in the presidential nominating contest in 2020, with the Democrats ultimately having 15 or 20 people running. I think we'll probably see it more clearly then. But it is a factor in these midterms. And ultimately, you know, if they nominate some candidates who can't win, or if they take some positions in some key races that become a problem, that's going to affect their ability to take a majority in Congress.
We have been talking with Matt Kowiak, who is president of the Potomac Strategies Group. He's also a columnist at The Washington Times, has a podcast. So, Matt, tell us where folks can find all of the above.
Absolutely. I'm on Twitter at Matt Makowiak. You can find me there. My website for our firm is PotomacStrategyGroup.com. The podcast is called Mac on Politics. We've had some extraordinary guests, cabinet secretaries, U.S. senators, congressmen, leading journalists and authors, ambassadors, you name it. You can find the podcast on iTunes, on Stitcher, on Google Play. It's called Mac on Politics. I think we're up to 123 five-star ratings, so hope folks can check that out.
Matt Kowiak of the Potomac Strategies Group. Matt, thank you for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
In the state of California, you can't become a firefighter if you have a criminal record. But yet those actually serving time in prison are being used to help fight wildfires. Eric Baim of Reason Magazine files this report.
Well, the wildfires that are currently burning across parts of California are some of the largest and most destructive that state has ever seen. And the largest of them, which is burning up near Redding, California, in the northern part of the state, is actually the biggest in California history. Now, there are thousands upon thousands of firefighters battling those blazes, including a few thousand that are not professional firefighters at all, but actually inmates in the California Department of Corrections system. But those people who are putting their lives on the line to defend property and lives right now against these wildfires, when they get out of prison, well, they won't be allowed to become actual firemen and firewomen. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Baim with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me today. Instead, I want to put a spotlight on these occupational licensing rules in California that strike me as just making absolutely zero sense in light of the news, in light of the really terrifying news of these giant wildfires that are burning across the state. Now, as I said, the largest wildfire in California's history continues to burn out of control across more than 300,000 acres in Northern California. And there are inmates from the California Department of Corrections system who are helping professional firefighters battle those flames. Those inmates are literally risking their lives. They're risking their lives to protect people, homes, property, businesses, all the rest, as part of the state's volunteer inmate firefighter program. They're not just plucked out of the prisons and forced to go fight the fires. They volunteer for this. But they get paid less than $2 per day for their work, even as they toil alongside professionals who are making an average of more than $70,000 a year, and that's before overtime and high-risk pay and things like that. But the really cruel twist to this story is that once those inmates are released from prison, those same men and women will not have the opportunity to put their skills to use, because California's licensing laws prohibit individuals with criminal records from becoming firefighters. And it doesn't make any sense to shut people out of careers where they could make a good wage and support themselves after they get out of prison, especially when those people are already trained and qualified, and especially if the state law is only going to block them out, not because they're a danger to society, but because of old or irrelevant convictions that they've already served their time for. Now, California's inmate firefighter program is open to prisoners who are not convicted of arson, sexual crimes, kidnapping, or gang-related offenses. You want to keep those guys locked up. They don't get to be part of the firefighting team. The program is also closed off to anyone with a history of escape attempts, obviously, and anyone who is facing a life sentence or the death penalty. The inmates who volunteer for the program get a 2-week training in firefighting, and they have to pass a physical exam. The Department of Corrections says there are more than 2,000 volunteer firefighters, including 58 youth offenders, that have already been deployed to fight the Mendocino Complex Fire, which is actually a set of two different fires that have burned over 300,000 acres near Redding, and now that is the fire that's being considered the largest in state history. But the inmates are used to fight smaller fires, too. According to the New York Times, about half the firefighting personnel at any California wildfire will be part of the inmate program. And using inmates and paying them so little compared to professional firefighters allows the state to save about $100 million every year. But then, when those inmates get done serving their time, they go out into the real world, and if they want to become a firefighter, they learn pretty quickly that they first have to be certified as an EMT, as an emergency medical technician. Almost every county in the state requires that firefighters get licensed as an EMT. Now, there's no problem with passing the classes or the tests that they have to do, but state law allows licensing boards to block anyone with a criminal record from getting an EMT license. And that's any criminal record at all, not just ones for arson or kidnapping or those other crimes that keep you from being able to work in the firefighting program when you're in prison. Being unable to use in-demand skills makes the adjustment to post-prison life more difficult for the formerly incarcerated, who often lack solid job prospects and have a hard time finding work, and it unnecessarily reduces the number of qualified and trained firefighters in a state where wildfires are obviously a pretty serious concern. It also means that the time and money spent training inmates to battle wildfires is at least partially being wasted, because once those people leave the correction system, they can't use those skills anymore. It might also increase crime in the long run, because with fewer options for legal work, people who get out of prison are more likely to resume a life of crime. A 2017 study from Arizona State University looked at licensing rules and recidivism rates across all 50 states over a 10-year period and found that formerly incarcerated residents are more likely to commit a new crime within 3 years of being released from prison if they live in a state where they are prohibited from getting a license solely for having a criminal record. And according to the American Bar Association, there are more than 12,000 different restrictions in state licensing laws that limit the career choices for the roughly 70 million Americans with a criminal record. Many of those restrictions are what the National Employment Law Project calls blanket bans. They leave no room for an applicant to argue his or her case, an argument that an applicant could make, for example, by pointing out that they've been trained to fight wildfires while in prison. Instead of blanket bans, the National Employment Law Project suggests that states should write licensing laws that include specific prohibitions for specific criminal offenses, exactly the way the California Department of Corrections approaches their inmate firefighter program. But California licensing laws lack that nuance, and that means that people who get out of prison in the state often lack serious opportunity to turn their lives around. Lawmakers in California could start making those improvements by recognizing that the inmate firefighters who are risking their lives to fight the state's biggest wildfire deserve a chance to do that exact same thing once they are no longer locked up. It's an easy, common-sense fix that would get more firefighters on the front lines to battle these fires, would help formerly incarcerated individuals turn their lives around, and would avoid wasting the time and resources that's spent on training these inmates to fight wildfires in the first place. But of course, this is California, so even something that makes perfect sense probably won't happen. And indeed, just this past year, lawmakers had an opportunity to vote on a bill that would have ended the prohibition for granting EMT licenses to anyone with a criminal record, but they declined to do so. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage on occupational licensing laws and specifically this issue of occupational licensing for firefighters in California by heading over to Reason.com. And we'll be right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The left is having fits over President Trump's relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin. This after having a cozy relationship with that country and its leaders for decades. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has this American Radio Journal commentary.
Nancy Pelosi wakes up every day wondering what the Ruskies are up to. Every single day, tweeted the San Francisco Democrat turned cold warrior, I find myself asking, what do the Russians have on Donald Trump, personally, financially, and politically? Well, good question. But in the meantime, gee, Congresswoman Pelosi, I never knew you were such a Russia hawk. Actually, I never knew the entirety of the Democratic Party and the progressive movement were such saber-rattling hardliners. Obama CIA chief John Brennan claims that President Trump, quote, is wholly in the pocket of Putin, unquote. Well, during the Cold War, John Brennan was wholly for Gus Hall to be president of the United States, and Hall was wholly in the pocket of the Kremlin. In fact, the Kremlin put in the pocket of Gus and his Communist Party USA millions of dollars in illegal subsidies every year, and John Brennan voted for Gus Hall to be president. But John Brennan, too? Well, he's now a Russia hawk. He's gunning for the Ruskies. What is it with you liberals? What's next, Dems? A resurrection of the House Committee on Un-American Activities? Maybe Maxine Waters grilling staffers in the Trump White House? Are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? It's only a matter of time before Hillary Clinton heads to Wheeling, waving a list of 205 Russian spies at the Trump State Department. Where's old tail gunner Joe Biden to charge Trump with a conspiracy so immense? The hypocrisy is outrageous. It's outrageous that it took charges of Russian meddling against Hillary Clinton to finally make progressives about the dangerous deceit of the Kremlin. For 100 years, the Kremlin has engaged in misinformation, murder, and mayhem. The Russian word for disinformation is desinformatsiya. I wrote the foreword to a book on the subject titled Disinformation by the highest-ranking Soviet bloc defector, Lieutenant General Ion Mihai Pachepa. Liberals never gave a rip about Russian agitprop. Quite the contrary, they dismissed it as paranoia by red-baiting right-wingers. The Russians orchestrated deliberate active measures campaigns against the Reagan administration throughout the 1980s. And yet, when conservatives called attention to spies, dupes, fellow travelers, and agents of influence, liberals ridiculed us as McCarthyites. Glad to see the progressives finally care. So where were they when we tried to get them to pay attention to their hero, Ted Kennedy, and his secret overtures to the KGB? I suppose they're ready to open their op-ed pages to guys like me to weigh in on a scandalous dossier sitting somewhere in the Kremlin ripe for blackmail, but only if the dossier pertains to Donald Trump. As listeners here know, beginning over a decade ago, I published in English and Russian a May 1983 KGB document on Ted Kennedy. I've also, however, tried to determine if the Kremlin is holding a larger Kennedy file. I would bet my house that there's a big, thick, ugly file on Ted Kennedy somewhere in Lubyanka. Kennedy was a perfect target for blackmail. It makes you wonder what Moscow fully had and still has on Senator Kennedy. Donald Trump a party boy? How about Ted? Trump is a teetotaler. Teddy was a lush. Liberals were silent on Ted and the KGB, but not on Trump and the KGB. Nowadays, reporters at the New York Times and CNN are practically modern-day John Birchers in pursuit of the grandest of Moscow conspiracies. It's now a full-blown crusade against the Ruskies by liberals. The guns and gulags and Yalta and Katyn Woods and Alger Hiss and the Rosenbergs, none of that fired them up. But hell hath no fury like a Hillary supporter scorned by the Kremlin. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include WWSM-AM in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, KEST-AM in San Francisco, California, along with KTLX-FM in Columbus, Nebraska. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.